Well, today I'm going to continue on the subject I spoke on a couple weeks ago, kind of add a little bit more on the idea of syncretism and blending, how it is that we blend religions and how the evil result that is. But today we're going to take a little different tack. I want to begin over in Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy 25, we simply have, obviously, the last part of Moses' life. He's giving us a kind of giving the people of Israel his final words, his admonitions, and passing on some inspired words from God. But in here, he mentions God said there was to be some vengeance taken, or you might just say some punishment, appropriate punishment taken. Deuteronomy chapter 25, let's begin in verse 17. God says, "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt. How he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary and did not fear God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies round about, in the land from which your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek under heaven, and you shall not forget." This wasn't an admonition to obey the commandments of God or his statutes or to be very careful in the sacrifices. This was, God said, these people are evil and they did you wrong by attacking your stragglers and those at the back. And then you are then to go blot them out of existence. Now, we'll go through some of this history. But just as a personal note, the Amalekites are still, you might say, well known among the people of the modern state of Israel. Things may have changed somewhat since my first year there, obviously. But during the summer of 1974, I was blessed to be able to go with 27 other Ambassador College students over to the Dig in Jerusalem, over at the Temple Mount that we were working with Dr. Benjamin Mazar, a very wonderful young man, not young, but wonderful man. He loved all of us. He's just a great guy to work with. And a couple other professional archaeologists. But we went over there in 1974 in June. In April of 1974, in fact, on April 11th, three Palestinian commandos had crossed the border up to the north. They came down from Syria across the Golan Heights. They hiked 6 miles through the Israeli territory in the darkness, and they attacked a school at what was called Kiryat Shemona. You will still occasionally hear about Kiryat Shemona in the news. It is one of the most northern settlements in the land of Israel. And it was a very, very difficult time. They took all of the little children there hostage. They shot a few of the teachers, and they boarded up the school and demanded release of about 100 Palestinian prisoners that were in various Israeli jails. If you've read Moshe Dayan's book or Ariel Sharon's book called Warrior, I've read biographies of all the modern-day leaders of that nation of Israel. But Moshe Dayan said it was one of the most difficult and worst days of his life because it went on. The negotiations went on all day, and finally the Israelis said, no, we're not going to. So the Palestinians ended up shooting a lot of the children. And, of course, the teachers and they themselves then killed themselves. And I say that because a few weeks later in June, would have been 8 weeks later, we were on a small bus, about 30 of us. We were going up to the Golan Heights, and Mr. Richard Franklin was going to show us some of the sites in Israel. And we drove right by that Kiryat Shemona grade school. I remember looking out the window, and 20 feet away were all these bullet holes. By that time, they had put a barbed wire fence around it. But the bus driver just said, this is one of the most tragic things to ever happen in our nation's history, when all these little school children, I think the number of school children killed was something like 28. But I drove right past that. I remember that was my first experience, you might say, being in a war zone. And so at that time, I'm not sure how it is now, but at that time, if you were to take a cab or a taxi in the land of Israel, especially around, you know, Jerusalem or other places, Tel Aviv, if you got in the taxi, by the way, all cars had to stop to pick up Israeli soldiers. We would be going down the street in a bus, and there would be a busload of soldiers disgorged, and all the cars pulled over to the curb because all of them, by law, had to pick up Israeli soldiers and take them home. But when you got out of the taxi, or the soldier got out of the car to go back to where he's going, they didn't say goodbye. You know what they said? They said, remember the Amalekites. And the Jews would say goodbye during that very difficult time, I'm not sure if they still do, by telling each other, remember the Amalekites. Well, we're going to talk about the Amalekites today, at least in the first part. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 36. We know by their nature that the Amalekites attacked women, children, those who couldn't fight back. There were some who did attack or did in this one battle here that we'll look at. But the Amalekites were descendants of Esau. And as you know, Esau swore to kill Jacob after Jacob had taken the blessing and the birthright through deception from his father. And he had Isaac. And then he, of course, even when Esau and Jacob got back together and they both were plenty wealthy and Jacob had sent these three processions of gifts along to Esau, Esau never said, I forgive you and I will not kill you or take back my promise. So apparently that curse, that promise to kill the sons of Jacob was still on the minds of these descendants of Esau years later. Genesis 36 and verse 12. Now Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek. So Amalek was a grandson of Esau. To Eliphaz, these were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. So the Amalekites were descendants of Esau. And they go back to not a legitimate wife, but a concubine of his son, Eliphaz. Now let's go up to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17. This is the first account of Amalekites. These would be the descendants, the children, grandchildren, those who descended from Amalek. And of course, he was a grandson, you might say an illegitimate grandson of Esau. Exodus chapter 17. Verse 1 says, all the congregation of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and they camped in Rephidim. But there was no water there for the people to drink. Therefore, the people contended with Moses, saying, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt me? So here we have waters that, you know, the people were thirsty. We're all familiar with these stories coming out of Exodus, coming out of Egypt. This was before they got to Mount Sinai. Verse 6, Moses says, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock. Actually, God said that to Moses, and water will come out of it. This is the first time he was to strike the rock, the second time he was to speak to the rock, but he didn't. He struck it, and therefore he didn't get to go into the promised land. Verse 7, so the name of the place was Massah, or Meribah, because of the contention of the people of Israel. Now, right after that, verse 8, Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. So right after they were thirsty and they'd gathered around this rock that Moses struck once with his staff and water came out of, right after that, the Amalekites came up and attacked the people of Israel. Moses said to Joshua, choose us some men to go out to fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses had said to him and fought with Amalek. So there must have been several thousand on each side at least. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. So Moses had lift up his hands so that God was, you know, going to bless the fighters, Joshua and all the army. And when he let down his hands, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. So that would have been an interesting sight. Look up on the hill, and there's Moses sitting there on a rock with Aaron on one side and Hur on the other, each holding up one of his hands. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So it was an all-day thing. Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua. Notice what God said here. I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. For Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner. For he said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. So Amalek was not on the bright side of blessings. He was on the wrong side. He apparently inherited the anger of Esau And certainly God was not pleased with what he did or what his descendants did. Now let's go to Judges chapter 3 and verse 13. So later in the scenario of Israel, after Joshua's conquest of the land was finished, and Joshua had not taken an army and gone and attacked Amalek. They were very busy conquering the Amorites and the Hittites and the Jebusites. And so they were settled in those lands. They were no doubt exhausted after those years, about 7 years of fighting. Judges chapter 3, we find that God allowed the Amalekites to punish Israel for their disobedience. Judges chapter 3 and verse 13. It says, "Then he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, and went and defeated Israel and took possession of the city of Palms." That is the city of Jericho. It's down on the Jordan River to the south of the Dead Sea, and it is, or to the north of the Dead Sea, and it is called the City of Palms, a very, very important city, perhaps the oldest continually inhabited city on the face of the earth, at least that's what some people believe. So the Amalekites went and punished Israel. God used them to punish Israel. And notice the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. So because of their disobedience, recorded for us in the book of Judges, this is the first time God punished them. We have then, they were serving Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. When the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them called Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjaminite, a left-handed man of the tribe of Israel. He sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. And I think you know probably the rest of the story, that the Israelites then were spared and they had a number of years of peace. So the people apparently of Israel had apparently forgotten what God had done for them, and they then were subjected to the Amalekites for punishment. Now let's go on over to Judges chapter 6. Judges chapter 6. We find that the Amalekites were a thorn in the side of the people of Israel. They would come in at night and steal grain. They would burn fields. They would attack those who were weak. Judges chapter 6, beginning in verse 3. "So it was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them, and they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza." So they would destroy their crops, so the Israelites would have nothing to eat for the winter. "And they would leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. They would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land and destroy it." And so it was greatly impoverished because Israel was impoverished by the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And so then we have the story of Gideon, which you're very familiar with, who then took his army of 300 with their little lamps and broke the pots the lamps were in. And, of course, the people of the Midianites, which would have been a conglomeration of a lot of nations around there, armies around there, and God gave them, Israel then, a victory. Now let's go over to 1 Samuel chapter 15, because the Amalekites are mentioned a number of times. You get into the book of Samuel, and we have a little different story as to what happens here. The first time Israel has a king that can lead an army, it's kind of the first king after the time of all the judges. And God said, well, the people under Joshua and under the judges, all those hundreds of years, the people of Israel did not blot Amalek out. So one of the first jobs that God gives King Saul, the first king of Israel, is to go and attack the Amalekites. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 1. "Samuel said to Saul, 'The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore heed the words of the voice of the Lord.'" So we have Saul being made king. We have some battles he'd won before that with his son Jonathan over the Philistines. So here we have the first official task or job that he's given as king. He says, "Therefore, heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel." In other words, Amalek hadn't been punished yet. "How he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack the Amalekites, utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them. kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey, which is what the Amalekites had tried to do to Israel. They'd tried to kill the women and the children along with the men. And of course, they killed many of the animals. So Saul gathered the people together and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. So here we have 210,000. That's an awfully large army. That's an amazingly large army. And of course, by today's standards, it's still a large army. But 200,000 men of Judah. Saul came to a city of Amalek and lay in wait in the valley. Now, how they can lay in hiding with 210,000 men is more beyond me, because they've got to have wagons for food and supplies, but they did it. It says, Saul said to the Kenites, "Go and depart." So there were some Kenites living in the same vicinity, perhaps the same town as the Amalekites. It says, "Get down from the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them, for you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So this different family, the Kenites, left the Amalekites alone. And Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. So apparently a good 15, 20-mile field of battle here. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive. Now, why would he do that? Well, either to parade him around as a trophy in front of the people of Israel in order to gain popularity for himself, or to hold him as hostage and perhaps get lots of silver and gold to have him ransomed by other Amalekites or other people that would have known him. So here we have a disobedient king, King Saul, because he keeps Agag alive. Verse 8, he took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good. And they were unwilling to utterly destroy them. So they wanted to take plunder, which is the typical, you know, expected, you might say, salary or payment for enemy soldiers when they conquer an area, is they can steal and take all that they want. And all down through history, there have been armies conquering foreign territories just to steal everything they had, plunder. Now, the Vikings were famous for doing that for several centuries between about 700 BC or AD and about 1100 AD. Anyway, we have the army took plunder. Saul allowed it. It says, "Everything despised and worthless they utterly destroyed." So the garbage they left behind. Now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, "I greatly regret that I have made Saul as king, for he has turned back from following me. He has not performed my commandments." And it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night. So now we get into the section of this account that tells us a lot about human nature. Tells us a lot about the way people think, that they can delude themselves into believing they have obeyed God when truly they have not. It's not just for us to point the finger at King Saul. It's for us to examine our own lives, because 1 Corinthians 10 tells us these things happened for our example, that we might not sin as they did. And so people often try to then sort of twist and turn and change and alter what God has said to do, because they have a slightly different idea. They want to do it their way, and of course there's always a self-congratulatory or self-enhancing reason for doing so. Verse 12 says, "Saul went up to Carmel, and indeed he set up a monument for himself." What does that tell you about Saul? He was like most modern-day politicians. In fact, like most politicians, political leaders in the last 6,000 years. He didn't set up a monument for God and give God thanks for the victory. He set up a monument for himself. He says that he has gone around and passed by and gone down to Gilgal. Then Samuel went to Saul. And what did Saul do? Did Saul say, "You know, thank you, Samuel, we want to thank God for this great victory"? No, Saul felt guilty. He knew that he had sinned, but he wanted to pretend that he hadn't sinned. So he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord, I have performed the commandment of the Lord." It's a very good lesson in faulty human reasoning. We can easily deceive ourselves in thinking we have obeyed God when we really haven't. I think it's one of the reasons for the church divisions and splits over the many years, the centuries, and certainly why some people have justified disobeying very plain scriptures, because they've convinced themselves that they are doing what they think is right. And of course, the reason is, given a little bit later, is because they've convinced themselves they have a pure motive. Let's get down to that. Samuel said, "What is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen that I hear?" So Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites." So Saul is blaming somebody else. He learned that from our father Adam. God said, "Adam, what have you done?" He said, "The woman you gave me, she made me do it." So Saul said, "Well, these people, they did it." He blamed somebody else. Of course, none of us would ever be guilty of anything like that, I'm sure. Well, not intentionally, but it's human nature. This, you know, the Bible is the greatest psychology book in the world. It tells us more about how people think and warns us individually about how we ought not to think, because these are real accounts of people and how they have rationalized over the years. So Saul said, "Well, they have brought them." Of course, here Saul is making a monument to himself. "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen." The people did it. Of course, he gave them permission, perhaps even asked them to. Notice why. Oh, it's always so religious and so pure motive. "To sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." They always say that false doctrine begins with the scripture. In this case, we have direct disobedience to God, beginning with justification because we have a pure motive. We want to do what's right. We don't want to offend that person. We don't want to, you know, we don't want to be viewed as being unchristian. Whatever the modern day excuses and parallels and equivalents of this might be, we have heard them many times over the years. So Saul, then, after he lied, after he made a monument to himself, then he blamed others. Now he says, "Well, we've done what's wrong, but for a good motive. We're going to sacrifice all these animals to God. Everything else we have thrown away." So the wheels are turning in Samuel's mind now, and obviously Saul has tried to make excuses. He's tried to wiggle his way out. There is obviously no repentance whatsoever, even though God had given him, you know, God's spirit had been with him. He had become a great warrior. At one point, he even walked with the prophets and, you know, prophesied, which means he simply said spiritual things, praises to God, whatever it might be. But here, Saul said to Samuel, verse 16, Samuel said to Saul, "Be quiet, and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said, "Speak on." So you notice Samuel didn't get into an argument with Saul about whether or not he obeyed. He didn't get into an argument about whether or not what he did was right or wrong. And it's a good lesson because we all have done this. There's a saying in child rearing that once you start arguing with a child, he's already won the argument. And the same is true as once you start discussing or trying to come to grips with those who have been openly sinning in rebellion, you've already lost. It's the argument itself that can be the downfall. In this case, Samuel was wise enough not to fall into that. And so Samuel said to Saul, "Be quiet, I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he, Saul, said, "Well, speak on." At this point, Saul is realizing that all of his creative arguments, his trying to blend worshiping God, obeying God, with his own disobedience and direct disobedience and making excuses for it isn't going to work. So Samuel said, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not the head of the tribes of Israel?" Now, how do we know that Saul was little in his own eyes when God asked him to be king? Remember the story? He went and hid. When he found out that Samuel was coming for him, he went and hid. He hid in a bunch of hay, I think it was. He got under the haystack and tried to hide so that no one could find him. So he was little in his own eyes at that point. "Did the Lord not anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners.'" Very straightforward, very simple. "Go and destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" It's an interesting Bible study just to see those who have sinned in the Old Testament accounts because they desired gold, silver. There's the one prophet who turned back and had all these, Elijah's servant wanted the coats and the gold that was offered to Elisha. And there are others where they compromise what they knew to be right because they were inveigled by silver and gold, by their greed. So in this case, Saul's greed apparently was what hurt him. So why did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? Notice Saul here, even with this direct admonition and direct words from God, Saul does not repent. Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord." Now he knew he hadn't. Samuel was very plain with him. God's message to him was very plain. But because he tried to combine his own desires with what God had said, he pretends and has convinced himself, "I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on a mission which the Lord God sent me and brought back Agag, king of the Amalekites, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites." Then he says, "But the people took of the plunder, the sheep and oxen. So I couldn't control these armies. I couldn't control all these men, these 200,000 men, whatever it was. I couldn't control them all, which should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." So Samuel said, this is a very important section of Scripture. This is a core teaching of the Bible in these next two verses. "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices?" Is God concerned with how much you serve and sacrifice and how much you do in physical things to serve him or to serve his people? Nothing wrong with it. It's good. It's part of your works. But it says, is God taking great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Obeying God is better than giving sacrifice. Obeying God is better than giving till it hurts. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. Doesn't say you shouldn't do sacrifice or should give to God or serve God in every way you can. It just says obeying is better. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. And to heed, in other words, to listen to what God says, is better than the fat of rams. And so the synchronism we see of blending the voice of God, the truth that he's given to us, the faith once delivered, trying to blend that with other religions, other teachings, with other ideas, it is just simply wrong. It is better to obey God completely than to try to sacrifice and do good works and do these things that we think will somehow make up for it. Verse 23, "For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry, because you have rejected the word of the Lord." Now notice, he didn't reject all of God's words. He did go and attack Amalek. He did kill a lot of the Amalekite people, but he rejected a portion of what God said to do. He didn't do it exactly as God said. But in God's eyes, he rejected everything that God had told him to do. "Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king." So God was fulfilling his vow that he had made through Moses. And of course, Saul simply showed a pattern of partial obedience. Saul's life was one of partially obeying what he was told to do. Now, in fact, this was the third time. We don't have time in today's message to go through the first two. But let's go back to chapter 13 and notice the attitude of human reasoning replacing the true submission to God. 1 Samuel chapter 13, let's go to verse 15. Verse 5. "The Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore, to magnitude, multitude. And they came up to encamp at Michmash, in the east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, then the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, and holes. So the people of Israel were scared. They were in hiding because of the massive number of the Philistine army that was facing them. Some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead." They went over to modern-day Jordan. Verse 8, "Saul was in Gilgal. He waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. Samuel had said, 'Go to Gilgal. I will be there, and I will offer an offering on your behalf so that God will bless this effort, and you can defeat the Philistines.' But Samuel didn't come on time." Samuel was late. He was late to the sacrifice. "As it happened, as soon as he had finished," verse 9, "so Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. Now, what was wrong with that? Saul was not a priest. Saul was not a Levite. He was a Benjaminite. He had no authority from God to offer a sacrifice. But people take authority themselves in religious ways because in their mind, they work out a good reason for it and a justification for it. And so they are in the same pattern as Saul. But it tells us something about Saul's pattern of partially obeying God. Yes, he was going to give a sacrifice, but he didn't do it in the way God prescribed. He took it upon himself to do what he thought Samuel wasn't doing a good enough job at. Now, can you imagine something like that happening in our time? I think that we could all list from memory occasions that would be in the same category. So here we have Saul bringing in his own offerings, and it happened as soon as he had finished presenting this burnt offering that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, "What have you done?" Samuel could see the smoke from the sacrifice going up from the altar. And Saul said, "Well, when I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you did not come within the days appointed." So now, in this case, he blames Samuel. "You didn't come in time appointed that the Philistines gathered. The Philistines were going to attack us. They were at Michmash. And you weren't here. We have to have this sacrifice so God will bless our efforts here in the war." Then I said, "The Philistines will come now on me in Gilgal. They're going to come kill us all if I don't do this. And I haven't made supplication to the Lord. So how could I go to battle without first making supplication to the Lord or giving a sacrifice? Therefore, I felt compelled." Yep. His justification for partially obeying and taking to himself authority to give sacrifices, the understanding of God's truth, he changed and twisted around. It was all done with, in his mind, a good purpose. Of course, it was wrong. And Samuel said to Saul, he didn't argue about why he was late. He didn't argue about the fact that Saul wasn't qualified to give a sacrifice. Samuel simply said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which God commanded you." Now, he partially obeyed what God had said to do. In his mind, he twisted and reasoned around and justified to where he convinced himself he'd obeyed God. And Samuel says, "No, you have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God." Very important lesson in human nature, because we could all fall prey to the same danger of twisting in our mind what God has said to do. Say, "My circumstance is different. You know, things have changed." On and on it goes, and come on to a conclusion that basically raises yourself up to a level that God has not ordained. Verse 14, "But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be a commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." So King David is going to be ruling over all of Israel in the time of the resurrection, the time of the kingdom of God here. And this is his qualification. He's a man after God's own heart. He tried to obey God completely, no matter what job he was given to do. So we have here this silly things that happened that Samuel did, or that Saul did. I want to finish his story over in 1 Samuel chapter 14. 1 Samuel chapter 14, let's begin in verse 20. In this case, King Saul goes way beyond his given task as being the commander and the king of the army. And instead of acknowledging God and asking for God's blessing and asking for forgiveness for what he had done, he instead takes this oath that turns out to be pretty much the last thing he's going to do as king. 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 20, "Saul and all the people who were with him assembled. They went to the battle. Indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in the battle. So the Philistines were defeated, and they were running away, the Israelite soldiers running after them. So the Lord saved Israel that day to the battle, and the battle shifted to Beth Aven. It's kind of in the middle central part of what was then Ephraim, the land of Manasseh, but is today, of course, what they call the West Bank. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under an oath. So this shows that the man lost his humility, lost acknowledging God or asking for God's help, and instead he makes a very out-of-place oath, one that hurt everybody. Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening, before notice, I have taken vengeance on my enemies. His repeated use of the word I and me and my. He's not acknowledging God. It doesn't say until God has taken vengeance on his enemies. It's saying nobody can eat or drink. Now you can imagine it's hot, it's sunny, it's desert, and they're running as fast as they can after the enemy with sword and shield in hand. And those shields weighed probably 40 or 50 pounds. The swords are also very heavy, made of iron. And so they would have been nice to have something to drink. Nice to have a little pause and have a little snack along the way. You know, the Roman phalanx, and how much you've studied what they call the turtle, the Roman phalanx, the Romans would not allow a soldier to fight on the front line for more than 20 minutes. They would line up seven deep in this phalanx, and every 20 minutes they would then move. The guy in the front would come to the back, and of course they would stay together, lock their shields, but they knew that a man would be exhausted after 20 minutes and would be likely to die in battle. So the Romans had a rule that that they could never, you know, Cassius basically reformed all the Roman armies in about the year 200 BC, and that along in that range, made that rule that simply no more than 20 minutes in the front line. And so it's one reason why the Romans were able to defeat the armies all over the Mediterranean. There were also a number of other ingenious things the Romans did. But that's a sidelight. The truth is, the matter here is that Saul, who we're talking about today, made a very incorrect oath, a very damaging and a wrong oath. And of course, as you know, the rest of the story, his son Jonathan didn't hear about this oath that they couldn't eat or drink anything, and he went by a tree that had broken down. There was honey coming out because of a nest, and he took some of that honey, and it became a sinful thing for the people, or for Saul, and for the rest of the army of Israel. I want to go over to John chapter 12. We'll go to the New Testament now. In John chapter 12, you know, John is the book that has the more condemning accounts of the Pharisees and Sadducees. John's written much later. Matthew has much more about the transition from the authority of the priests over to the authority of the apostles and disciples, Matthew 16, many other places. But in John 12 here, the religious leaders of their day had the same sin, which is partial obedience. They did the same thing as Saul, but in a slightly different way. John chapter 12 and verse 42 says this, "Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him." So this is talking about the Sanhedrin, the 70 rulers of the land of Israel, the nation at that time. Many believed in him. What does many mean? 20? 15? 30? Who knows how many of the 70? Zacchaeus came to him at night. Zacchaeus was one of them, and he said, "We know that you are a teacher come from God." So they knew, many of them did. But it says, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. In the Sermon on the Mount, Christ said, if you don't confess me before my Father in heaven, I will not confess you before my Father in heaven. And of course, the converse is true also. If we confess our faith in Jesus Christ here before men, Jesus Christ will confess his faith in our name before his Father in heaven. But these men, it says, they did not confess him, or did not even admit to their believing in him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. Their status, their importance in the religion was more important than being honest and truthful in what they believed. Notice verse 43, the reason. They love the praise of men more than the praise of God. If there was ever a profound psychological analysis of the way a man's mind works, the way a human's mind works, this is it. Men love the praise of men far more than the praise of God. Certainly should not be that way with converted people, but if you watch for this in the world around us, you will see it all the time on display, almost 100%. People love the praise of men more than the praise of God. So they had a synchronized religion in the sense that they partially obey. So they would obey behind the scenes, but not obey in openly. So we have these guys. Let's drop down a little bit farther now to chapter 18. Chapter 18 and verse 23. They admitted in private, but in public they would not admit that they believed that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. John chapter 18 and verse 23. Jesus answered him. This is one of the chief priest's officers struck Jesus Christ. This is during his arrest and trial. He says, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me? So he was struck, and he said, well, why are you striking me? What have I done that's evil? Tell me. And Annas sent him to Caiaphas the high priest. Now Peter stood and warmed himself and said, therefore they said to him, are you not also one of the disciples? Now this is kind of an interesting, you know, the train of events we go over every year before Passover. But Peter had said, well, even if everybody else abandons you and runs away, I will not. So he kept his word after the arrest in the Garden of Eden. I'm sorry, Garden of Eden, that's wrong. Garden of Gethsemane. Too many gardens in my head. In fact, my wife's had me working in the garden all week whenever I had time. But anyway, he did. He followed along as the Roman soldiers and all that cohort took Jesus Christ over to the house of Annas. Peter followed along way behind him. We find that John also did later because John was there at also one of the at the trial, I think, of Caiaphas. But he says, they asked Peter, are you not one of his disciples? And he said, I am not. One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of him who's here, had been cut off. So this guy knew for sure that Peter was there and had cut off this high priest's servant's ear. Did I not see you in the garden with him? But Peter, of course, denied him. So this hard heart or this challenge that he had here, once you start down this road of being dishonest or being deceitful, the road sins, it has no end to it. Verse 35, Pilate answered Jesus Christ, am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests who have delivered you to me, what have you done? And of course, Jesus simply said, my kingdom is not of this world. We know that religious hypocrisy abounds today. Now, thankfully, Peter repented of his sin. Peter repented of the things that he did that were wrong. I want to go over to how these things happen. Let's go first over to Ezra chapter 4. Just some red flags that God has in his word to warn us what to be wary of. What to be wary of. Let's go over to Ezra, just right after Chronicles, Ezra chapter 4. This is a very commonly used tool of Satan the devil. If we can't beat him, join him, but for the purpose of beating him, you might say this works out to be. Ezra chapter 4 and verse 1, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of God, Lord God in Israel, notice their first ploy. And this is often how Satan inspires people to work. It is sad sometimes that people in the true church of God sometimes have gotten sort of tricked into or sort of deceived into thinking they can join forces with people who believe differently and somehow come out ahead. So, chapter 4 and verse 2, they came to Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses and said to them, let us build with you. So the agents of Satan the devil, the evil people here, were trying to join with them. Not because they wanted to help build the temple, but because they wanted to have it destroyed. Satan hasn't changed his tactics. He would love to have the true church of God, and the faith once delivered, syncretized with false ideas and religions that are somewhat similar, and of course, for the final purpose of destroying the truth. One of the earlier examples of that was the only daughter we have record of Israel. Remember, her name was Dinah. I remember she got to be a teenager or whatever, wanted to go out and meet a bunch of young men. She didn't want to have her brothers telling her what to do anymore. So she went out and found the sons. Oh, was it the sons of Heth? Anyway, we don't have time to look at it. But what did they say? Well, why don't you give your daughter to our sons and our sons to your daughters, and we'll combine our forces. And afterwards, they said, everything they have, we will take. So the purpose wasn't to combine and build. The purpose was to combine and steal. The same is true here. Those adversaries wanted to combine and destroy. And so the syncretism, trying to get people to partially obey and then justify it and then join into a philosophy that is simply wrong, just like Saul did, the human mind can justify it. Satan's temptations can be very devious, very deceitful. But in this case, what did Zerubbabel say? They came to Zerubbabel and had the heads of the father's houses said to them, let us build with you. Notice, for we seek your God as you do. Oh, yes, we have the same religion. We have all these things in common. Come with us. What did he say to them? He says, we have sacrificed to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. So these men were known as the Samaritans. And they, of course, had a type of religion that sort of, it kind of mimicked the true religion, but they were sacrificing on Mount Ebal, and they, of course, had a very different system. They did have a copy of the Torah, but they simply did not worship God in the way he prescribed at all. But they said, we seek your God as you do. You know, beware of people that say, well, our church believes the same thing as your church. But Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers, houses of Israel, said to them, you may do nothing with us to build a house to the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. So since that ploy didn't work, the people of the land tried to discourage the people of Judah, and they troubled them in building. And they eventually hired counselors or people who would give a false testimony back to the king. So this idea, or this is one way, one tool of Satan we cannot be ignorant of, is that he would like to have us syncretize our truth, our way of life, what we have known for many, many years and proven, syncretize that with people who are honestly have a different goal, and their goal would be simply to try to destroy us. Let's go back to Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, which is the perhaps the best story of mankind written in one chapter anywhere in the world. The way that mankind has worked, the history almost ever since the time of Adam and Eve. So it mentions here they simply rejected God and went their own way. Now this chapter is very specifically and is detailed out on the friezes of the Parthenon in Athens. There's some several good books that analyze that have done a very good job with it. Romans chapter 1, verse 21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God. No, they glorified themselves. Remember what Saul did? He built an image to himself. That used to be quite the thing in the ancient world. They didn't have pictures. They didn't have, you know, photographs. So they made statues. Even Caligula and others who were pathetic rulers of Rome made hundreds and hundreds of statues of themselves everywhere around Rome. Of course, his were torn down after he was killed by the Praetorian Guard. When the Americans went into Baghdad in, 2006, whatever year it was, 2003, there were several wars over there. One, of course, was in early or middle 1990s. But there was a law Saddam Hussein had in Baghdad that at every street corner you had to see his face three times. So there were these big billboards, the big sides of the buildings with a picture of Saddam Hussein. And everywhere you went in Baghdad, at every corner, you had to see a picture of Saddam Hussein because he wanted to build images to himself. Now, the only thing I know of like that in America is that I do believe up in Seattle that at every street corner, you must be able to see three Starbucks. Because I've been up there enough times around there to know that everywhere you look, there's a Starbucks. So that may be something similar, maybe not. Maybe they're making an idol to themselves. Maybe they're just making money. But at any rate, we have, as it says here, they didn't like to glorify God, so they glorified themselves. They were not thankful. Remember, Saul wasn't thankful to God. He didn't thank God or thank Samuel for the blessings he'd been given, the victory in battle. But they became futile in their thoughts. They lost their purpose. They lost understanding of the great meaning of life, the great questions of life. And their foolish hearts became darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, They changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man. So they had statues of people that they said were gods. That's still with us today. And birds and four-footed animals and creeping things, those are rife all over the Orient, Middle East, India, Pakistan, all of those areas. Therefore, God gave them up to uncleanness and lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. And they exchanged the truth of God for the lie. I suppose many lies could be in this category. And they worshiped and served the creation rather than the Creator, who is blessed above all. So here we have just kind of the summary of the history of mankind. That here we have people who have been partially obedient to God to the place to where they're no longer obedient at all. Because it says that at one time they knew God, and they began to drift away in their own ideas of men, their own ideas that they came up with. And of course, eventually they lost everything. Let's go back over to Joshua chapter 23. We'll end up there today. Joshua's final admission, or final, you might say, admonishment to the people of Israel is interesting. Joshua chapter 23, to begin in verse 1. He actually had a fairly lengthy speech here. It came to pass, a long time after the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies round about, that Joshua was old, advanced in age, as he lived to be 110. So he was obviously older than most anybody else. The others who were in Israel would have been no older than about 80. Said he was old, advanced in age. Joshua called all Israel for their elders, for their heads, for their judges, for their officers, and said to them, I am old, advanced in age. You have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is he who fought for you. See, I have divided to you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for your tribes from the Jordan, with all the nations that I have cut off as far as the great sea westward. So all the way to the Mediterranean Sea from the river Jordan Valley, and of course north and south to the rivers. And the Lord your God will expel them from before you, and you shall drive them out of your sight, so you shall possess their land. So when Joshua died, there were still sections of the promised land occupied by the Amorite tribes. And Joshua was telling them, finish the job that God gave us to do. Verse 6, therefore be very courageous to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from the right hand to the left. So as they were commissioned to finish their job of conquering the promised land, the first thing he said is, be sure you do not deviate from the law that God gave us. So lest you go in among these nations, these who remain among you, you shall not make mention of the name of their gods. Don't even mention their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them. You shall not serve them, nor bow down to them. But you shall hold fast to the Lord your God, as you have done to this day. So we are in a parallel time. We have, I think, gone down the majority of the road towards God's kingdom. There certainly are a few years left. We don't know what it could be, but we are certainly in perilous times. But our job now is to hold fast to the Lord our God and to what he has told us, and not to be partially obedient, and not to mix God's truth with falsehood.